Hello, this is the podcast for our class on October 18, and that was class number 15. And in this class, we finished talking about duty entirely, and with our discussion of pure economic harm, and moved on to the third element in our cause of action for negligence, that is the element of cause in fact. So once we've gotten to this element, negligence is established. Now we have to find a link between that negligence and the injury. But before we do that, we talked about pure economic harm. And again, this is a class, one of the class of non-physical harms, non-physical being not related to a physical injury to your person or your property, just economic loss standing alone. And it usually comes in a professional context, either misdrafted will, the accountant liability, usually some kind of professional misconduct, negligence, that results in just purely losing out on a financial transaction of some sort. And as with emotional distress, there are two types of pure economic harm. One is sort of a third-party beneficiary economic harm, which means that there was some kind of contractual agreement between two other parties that would have benefited you or influenced you, and there was negligence on the part of one party. You lost out in financial terms, and now you're trying to sue that party. The other is indirect, like our bystander liability for emotional distress. And there's a physical injury to a third party based on negligent action. And because of that physical injury, you lost out financially. And we'll see in the first part, the so-called direct economic harm. There's some possibility of recovery, but on a very narrow scale. On the second time, there's indirect economic harm. Very little recovery allowed, only very small in jurisdictions. And it's always the reason behind our recovery or no recovery is that the courts want to keep our potential plaintiffs down to a manageable limit and not overwhelm defendants with peripheral lawsuits that go beyond the negligence. And we'll see again that proximate cause is another limitation on liability, but here we're limiting liability because of duty. We're saying no duty. And the first one is the idea of a negligently constructed financial statement, the NICAL case, that our stock buyer relied on, and then when the company Gulf went bankrupt, the stock buyer lost a lot of money and said, "I depended on this this financial statement, and I should recover from the auditors." And of course, any sort of relationship. And remember, here the reason we've got special duty rules is that we're dealing not with a physical injury. If it was a physical injury and somebody was doing something and they injured someone physically, they're going to be responsible. That's misfeasance and a physical injury results. But now, because we don't have a physical injury, we've got special duty rules based on the type of the injury. Since it's pure economic loss, the courts are going to look more critically at providing a recovery. And here we saw in the NICAL case, there were different schemes for providing recovery. Foreseeability of the potential plaintiffs is one, that's too broad. Our near privity requirement in the Ultramaris case, New York rules, too narrow. Here they tried to have some sort of balancing test based on the restatement section on negligent misrepresentation, the court found that that was a kind of provided a good midway ground for recovery. And still, there are rules. You know, there had to be the reliance. It had to be the knowledge that their financial statements were going to be used for a purpose, and then there had to be the fact that the financial statements actually led to this loss. And here the court said no, the prospect of the purchase had been happening well in advance. They didn't know that the business transaction had been going well in advance. So still no recovery. Think about occasions where this happens. There are cases that say that have dealt with, someone gets an assessment of a piece of art, for example. This is a genuine Picasso. Because of that, an art gallery asks for an appraiser. Appraiser says genuine. Purchaser buys it based on the appraiser's assessment, and it turns out to be, a Joe Schmo. Should the appraiser be liable to the purchaser? These kinds of situations come up. And again, courts have very limited times of recovery. So, negligent misrepresentation, Ultramaris, just a foreseeability test, all have been used by court, by various jurisdictions. Then you come to the third-party liability the Madison Avenue case, and very, very, very limited recovery in here. It's because courts have not been able to come up with a good test. It's not a privity situation. We don't need privity. There was an injury to somebody. A crane fell, a building fell. There were injuries somewhere, physical injuries, just not to our particular plaintiffs. And the court has decided they couldn't come up with they had to draw a line somewhere. You can't have it go on indefinitely without a physical injury. They have to draw a line, and I think we talked about that line there that said tort law is all about allocating loss. It's all about assessing risk, allocating loss. And when we're talking about businesses, you have to think they're just thinking, well, you can protect yourself through insurance. That's the way to do it, other than through tort. So it's a very much of a policy question and an interesting one. Particularly for, people who do this for a living, and that's what we're dealing with here, is just risk assessment and loss allocation. Where to put the loss in between two competing businesses, let the loss remain when we're talking just about economic harm. Then we moved on to our new section. Should be happy to say goodbye to duty and into cause and fact. And as we see, cause and fact, our classic but-for causation is not that difficult. And you can get rid of it in a sentence. If but for the negligence of my driving the car the wrong way down Church Street, your injury when I hit you wouldn't happen. That's all you need to say. It becomes tougher when we have multiple defendants, multiple possible causes, or we don't know what the cause of your injury is. And courts have grappled with how to deal with that. The Stubbs case, just good illustration. Lots of potential causes. We don't know what the but-for cause of the typhoid is. You know, Rochester, people were going to get typhoid anyway. Maybe our defendant was going to get typhoid. Our plaintiff was going to get typhoid anyway. But the courts could decided that instead of but-for, because that didn't work, they said, well, you know, there was enough correlation to provide a reasonable certainty. How much does that have to be? It's not 100%, but reasonable certainty, it's up there. What they did, basically, is, you know, we've got our, it's a question of facts, going to go to the jury. Are there enough facts for a reasonable jury to decide by a preponderance of the evidence that to a reasonable certainty the roily water, the tainted water, caused our plaintiff's typhoid. That's all we're dealing with. So are there enough facts to show to a reasonable certainty that this was the cause? Could a jury come up with a decision either way? And it's the same question that we came up with when we're talking about reasonable care. Question of fact for the jury doesn't mean you throw up your hands. You have to assess the facts that are available. Can the jury make a decision? And here in Stubbs, the court decided yes. Didn't mean that our plaintiff was going to win. It just meant it was okay to give this to the jury. So now, you know, we've moved on from but for reasonable certainty, and then we come to the really hard, the hard ones. And there are multiple defendants, but four doesn't work. What do we do? Now, we talked about, so we're going to move along next class. We know there are going to be questions. We've seen reasonable certainty. We know that we can use inference. You know, inference, we've seen it before. We're moving along into more use of inference. We don't want to speculate as to cause, but inference, we can use facts to create an inference. Next class, we'll talk about how we do this. Whenever we're leaving but for, though, you have to know, we have to make a decision. The probabilities. Sometimes we're talking about probabilities. Sometimes the probabilities are going to be so low, nobody gets recovery. Sometimes the probabilities mean that some undeserving plaintiffs will get something they didn't deserve. If everybody in Rochester sues the water company for getting typhoid, there's going to be a lot of people winning who, under the same circumstances as our Stubbs, there's going to be a lot of people winning who would have gotten typhoid anyway. So whenever we're talking about this probabilistic recovery, whenever we go below 100%, there's going to be overcompensation. Some undeserving plaintiffs are going to win. If we don't give anything below 100%, though, some deserving plaintiffs are going to lose. So it's the conundrum, the dilemma that the court faces when we leave but for causation, there's going to be either overcompensation or undercompensation, and the courts have to make a decision. All right, so next class we're going to start with Zukowicz. Please read Zukowicz, Alberts, plus all the material on joint and several liability. Very important. All of the ways that somebody can be held liable for the torts of another. We've seen respondeat superior, but now we're going to talk about indivisible injury, concerted action, and other ways that you can be held liable for the torts of another. So next class, we start with Zukowicz.